Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK fund manager Judith McKenzie of Downing. So welcome, Judith.
Good to see you, Paul. How are you doing?
Well, a bit sort of nervous and sort of battered, I think, after the sort of the markets, and particularly over the last sort of like 2 or 3 months since Trump got inaugurated. They've been swinging around left, right and centre. Small caps have, as I say, have been hammered. So it's a good time for you to come back onto the show. But we've always sort of run through your view of the markets and that uncertainty. Could you just quickly remind investors what type of stocks you like, what kind of investor you are?
Slow, thank goodness, a slow investor. So especially in these markets, you don't want to wake up and have to react too quickly because you're not quite sure what you're reacting to. So we invest in companies, a portfolio between 25 and 40 companies under 500 million market cap. And we're, I suppose we're looking at three buckets, and it's maybe worth mentioning this because as we go through some of the stocks, we could maybe try and put them in the buckets that we look at. So we're looking for self-help, and what does that mean? That can be anything from a company that's trying to improve its margins, and it's it might be going out and investing in a new warehouse, et cetera, et cetera. So just really trying to use their own powers to mitigate some of the market dynamics. We like balance sheet leaders, so those kind of companies that make you able to sleep at night, where you're not really worried about the debt levels within the companies that you're investing in. And I would say about two-thirds of the companies that we invest in have got net cash to the balance sheet. And then we're looking for what everybody's looking for, and that is those value compounders. So basically companies that are really good in terms of the return on capital employed and are very good at investing their own business and then generating cash. So all across the board, really, we're looking for cash generative businesses that are capable of cash generation in the portfolio. So those are the three main buckets that we're looking for at the moment. And that kind of plays into where we are in this this market cycle at the moment.
Yeah. And then in that context of those three buckets, you've got your self-help, you've got your balance sheet titans, and you've got your sort of a compounders, your growers, etc. How do you see their prospect, well, those buckets prospects more broadly, given the uncertainty in the markets? Because there's no doubt about it, it must be sort of like making a lot of sort of corporate leaders decide just to hold off on investments until the dust has settled in the next 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, and I think we've had a few conversations over the last couple of months where we've actually been giving management teams as much as we can do confidence in their own abilities to actually generate return on capital. Because you're right, there has been a few conversations where we felt that management teams have been sitting on their hands a little bit, and I think it will pay to be brave in these markets. Now actually what we've been doing, as you can probably imagine, especially over the last 2 or 3 weeks, is look at the portfolio on a tariff basis. Obviously we're not quite sure how the world is going to turn out in terms of tariffs, but if you look at the UK earners and the companies that we have in the portfolio here, I'm pleased to say, and touching wood when I'm saying it, but I am pleased to say that they typically are not having to have too much exposure to US tariffs. And I do think also, just thinking about market sentiment, And we've all been living through a period where market sentiment towards UK small caps been pretty tough over the last sort of 9 or 10 years, especially if you're at the value end of things. But I do feel that there is a bit of a turn in sentiment when we're speaking to investors, our investors, because for the first time in a long time, they're turning away from that US trade and thinking about where else to get value. And my goodness, there's so much value, as you know, in the UK market. So we are beginning to see investors actually make deployment decisions to reinvest again in the UK and also small cap markets. So whether that be the larger pension funds, the LGPSs, or actually right the way down to an IFA that's based in Leeds or Manchester.
Yeah. And what do you think in that small cap context, what do you think the sort of the prospects of AIM are? Because it's now trading at not far off. It's sort of like March 2020 low after, you know, at the start of that pandemic. It's sort of 660, 670, that sort of like, you know, number, etc. How do you see that? How can that be sort of jump started in terms of, I don't know, getting better valuations? Because it keeps going down.
Yeah. I've often said, don't look at AIM as an index itself. Look at it as a bit of a kind of an open shop window of some very good companies. And if you look at the number of companies that have come off the market, and I think it's down about 38% since 2018. And the market cap, if you think about it as a market cap of AIM itself, has fallen 60% since the peak in 2021, which kind of reiterates the point that you were just making there. So, you know, that's painful, yeah? And I think we've already got 44 odd companies that have come off the market or are considering coming off the market this year. And we're only at the start of the second quarter, so it's pretty painful. I think there does need to be a reboot on AIM. I don't think we can get away with the status quo. And as you probably know, the London Stock Exchange has actually just launched a consultation. So I would urge people to feed into that. And what we need is more buyers than sellers, obviously, but we also need more companies. And I think to get more companies, we need the confidence that there are more buyers. So it's all a bit self-perpetuating. But to get that, I think you do also need to have a look at the regulation and the cost of AIM and really just attracting growth companies onto the market. It's not certainly not conducive at the moment to encouraging private companies to come to market. And I don't think the solution is necessarily just PICES, which is the private market trading venue that the stock exchange is putting forward. It actually needs to be much more root and branch. So as I say, I would encourage people to actually feed into that consultation.
There's quite a few companies actually deciding to step up to the main market from AIM, isn't there? Because Gamma Communications has sort of decided they're going to move. And I think, is it Marlowe are considering it as well? So there's a number of big stalwarts.
Yeah, there's a few that are definitely considering it. I would be careful for what companies wish for here, because I'm being cynical just for once, but I'm being cynical because we know of a number of brokers that are encouraging companies to move up, and looking at the price list for a broker, if you're moving a company up to from Main to AIM, you're probably going to net in about £1.8 million. And we know that trading volumes have been down in the market more generally for quite a lot of brokers. So I think it's pretty dangerous for companies to move up without actually thinking about what the consequences are. I think if you're not going to fall into the 250, then you're going to be in a no man's land. And not only are you going to be paying, or shareholders paying, for that 1.2 to 1.8 million to move up to the full list, but your ongoing costs, audit costs, for example, are probably going to go up from about 350k to close to £1 million. Never mind the reporting, internal reporting that you're going to have to do as well. And to what end? Are you going to get a nirvana of more shareholders looking at you, potential shareholders? I just don't see that, because most UK institutions, aside from one who's well known at not investing in AIM, tend to invest in AIM. So, and it's not that you're just suddenly going to get a plethora of US shareholders investing in you. If you look at one of our companies called Sigma Rock, they actually now have got around about two-thirds of their shareholder list that is non-UK holders. So it proves that can actually be done on the AIM market, you've got to have the right offering, you've got to have the right messaging, and you've got to be of a reasonable size on AIM now as well. But it doesn't mean that you have to go to the full list to get attract new shareholders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if we just rebrand, you know, AIM and reduce the cost of regulation, the audit costs and the listing fees, and make it simpler to raise money and all that kind of stuff, and where it, effectively move it to where it should have been originally, and stop putting all this layers and layers of regulation, then I think it will make it a lot easier for investors, and particularly the reduce the costs for companies. Anyway, if anybody wants to ask Judith any questions, please put them into the chat box and I'll read them out. Let's go to one company that has done really well for you, Cohort in Defence. Largely, it's a buy and build sort of services in cyber warfare, electronics, and has done really, really well over, not surprisingly, over the last few years, given what's been happening in Ukraine and the South China Seas and the Middle East. How do you see this one going forward? The shares are over £11 today.
Yeah, they've done, as you say, very well for us. We have been a holder of that business for, gosh, probably about 6 or 7 years, I think. Mm. And now we're seeing the record order book and order cover. They bought a business, as you know, EMS in Australia. And so the next thing for us here is to see that that is integrated well. We think it will be. I say integrated, they're probably going to leave it to run relatively autonomously. But it looks like a really nice business. And, you know, how do we value it? It's got probably around about a 5% free cash flow yield. Mm. And we're looking at the EMS business there and thinking that a sort of fair value of about £13 or thereabouts, around about, right? Of course, what we're really looking for now is a little bit more meat on the bones around the defence review. And you know, whether that's really going to be quite as tangible as we think it should. Obviously, we've seen that spending has been increased worldwide pretty much, but we're really looking to see the detail around that for the next phase of this journey with Cohort.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to engineering company Avingtrans. It basically does sort of a discrete, or should we say bespoke products like nuclear safety boxes, blastproof doors. It does HVAC, specialist HVAC equipment for data centers, alongside pumps and motors and stuff for the nuclear sector. The shares, given the market, have just kept on going down, but they came out with some pretty strong first, in fact, record Q1 results. Yeah. And they've got this this healthcare medical specialist division, which does 3D x-rays, and they're submitting one for MRIs into the FDA out in the States. How do you see this one going forward?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe ask you the question. Do you think people don't understand it? You know, you just spent 2 or 3 minutes there describing what the business does, everything from healthcare to engineering to energy. And I think there's an element of these markets don't like anything that's too, might be perceived as too confusing. But we've talked about this one before. This for us is a real kind of sum of the parts argument. And you can split the businesses down and actually value them separately. If you look at the AES business, that's probably, well, I think we say it's between sort of worth 100 and 120 million. I think Stingers, the brokers, are probably saying 150 to 190. And that, so on our estimates, that would come out about £3 to £3.30. Medical, they've invested about £19-20 million there. It's got a kind of implied negative value at the moment, which doesn't feel right. And then you've got the EES sub companies, and that's probably about £50 to £70 million as well. So we think you can get to a share price of at least 500p plus thereabouts. Mm. And I think some of the other analysts are looking probably about 600 or 700p. So from a sum of the parts valuation basis, pretty comfortable with it. And you know, they're good at executing. At this stage, they probably, to get shareholder recognition, they maybe need to sell off one of the businesses. And the one that I think was probably most likely to get sold off was the Booths business. So that's the
glass-proof
doors. Nuclear, blast, I can't even say it, blast proof doors, yeah. And that's obviously quite geared towards the nuclear industry. But they've actually just, in the latest results, they have announced a record order book there. And they've now got the margins in that business really singing quite nicely. So I get the impression that they probably want to hang on to that for a little bit longer. And so the management team are doing all the right things. But, you know, for us, it's one that we just continue to top up on when the share price is a little bit weak because of that sum of the parts argument, and knowing fine that this is a management team that are going to deliver on that breakup value, really. Medical's in there for free for us to a certain extent, which I think actually in due course could be really quite exciting.
Yeah, they've talked about actually spinning off that medical devices business in sort of 2 or 3 years. I'm with you. When you look at the chart, you just see it. If you put an overlaid AIM, it's just gone down with AIM essentially, and people have sold it off. Got a bit worried about tariffs, but I think 50% of the actual business is aftermarket. It's services, and I think their biggest country is actually the US. So they're well balanced.
Yeah. No, we looked at the tariff argument the other day with it, so we're not overly worried about the exposure there.
Yeah. Okay. We've got a question from Stefan. He's asking about one we don't talk about a great deal, which has had a tough time. Is Inspecs, which does sort of like manufacturers' spectacles under its own brand, and also it licenses in brands to do for its own sort of like sales, etc. It's about 2 or 3 years going through a bit of a turnaround. I don't know if you own this one, Judith, but if you do...
We do, yeah. We own about 7 or 8% of it. How do we view... We came in... I can't remember the price at the time of the IPO, but we came in significantly below that. I think probably on the... I don't know how many profits warnings it's had either, but it must be nearly two hands, I think, over the time since it IPO'd. We probably only caught the last sort of one and a half. So it has been a serial disappointer. However, we think here there's an element of self-help. You can see how the margin should improve through further efficiencies and just a bit more operating leverage as well. It's been one of those, I talked about balance sheets at the very start, didn't I? Mm-hmm. Been one of those that has been over-geared. But what we saw was that the margin improvement, a kind of refining of some of the brands, and also just really trying to get that operational improvement coming through, has started to improve margins and also help decrease the debt levels. The key thing, I suppose, over the next 3-4 months or so is going to be the appointment of the new chair. And so it's public information, but there's the chair is stepping back and there will be a new chair going in place. So I think you look at this business, it's more than capable of a 10% free cash flow yield, then you're really, you know, it's not a demanding price that you're on at the moment, but it does need a little bit of self-help.
Yeah. What type of pricing power has it got? I mean, it makes sort of 6.5% EBIT margins.
Yeah, it depends on the market, really. There are some markets that are a little bit commodity. However, some of the European markets are a lot more affiliated to brands, so they've got better pricing power there. A lot of what, you know, the margin erosion over the last couple of years has actually been because they've not been that efficient in terms of their operations.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got another question from John. He's asking another turnaround one. Is Flowtech Fluid Power, that's got a bit of a rock star shareholder register. I think you're on there, and the Harwood boys are also on there. And I think the chairman, Roger McDowell, has turned around numerous businesses. It does distribution of sort of hydraulic and pneumatic parts into the industrial sector. But clearly that's been a tough area. But the turnaround has taken a long time. And the CEO is well respected. I guess it really comes down to, even though everybody is very capable, is this business possible? Is it possible to get it singing and back to where it should be?
I think that's a very good question, actually. So, yes, we're in there alongside. I mean, Roger is obviously on Avingtrans as well, and well known for being a good turnaround specialist. And Jamie Brooke, who we know again is a private equity chap, is on the board here too. So got all the right components. It's not the easiest business in the world. So in very sort of broad terms, they are a bit like the Amazon for the industrials market. So they, I think they were beginning to get their ship in order just on the margin side of things through the course of the last sort of 6-8 months or so. But you've got some real headwinds, don't you, in the industrial space. Mm-hmm. And of course, now you probably, it was probably one of the businesses that we own actually has got the most exposure to potential tariffs as well. So saying that, if they meet guidance, and that's a big question mark, you could see it at a kind of aspirational 200p level on mid-teens margins, but you've got quite a long way to get there. And I do, I've got a question mark after the results last week as to whether the forecast in the market are achievable. They are quite punchy. You do, just looking at the numbers from last week, you need those efficiencies really to be start kicking through to be able to get the margins up to where they need to be. Gross margins around about 39% at the moment. So that feels as though it's topped out. So it's really sort of the lines below that you need to get singing a little bit better. But the guidance does look a little bit challenging at the moment.
Yeah. What's the tariff exposure? Do they sell into the States, do they?
Yeah, yeah. So they're selling worldwide.
Right, okay. Really,
yeah. Yeah, not all US, you know, industrials in Europe, obviously as well, big part of their business. But yes, they are selling into the US too. And, you know, some of the story here is that they've been really good at buying. It's quite a fragmented market in this space. So really good at buying kind of mom and pop type operators that were themselves all quite locally branded. And what they've been trying to do is still keep some of those brands, but get the consolidation of the distribution much better. So there, you can see how they can do it. It's the execution and the time to execution that has been probably a hamper for them, and now slightly more challenging markets in the industrial space.
Right. Okay. Good. Okay. Let's move to another sort of a industrial. Let's go to oil and gas. We've got in services business Ashtead Technologies that does all things submarine or under the actual sea, etc. For the oil and services, oil and gas. Out in the North Sea and around the world, and likewise have started, I think about a third or so, or 40% has moved into renewables. They've been in a bit of a buy or build strategy. The results came out, they were very good, but the shares, having gone through a, you know, really strong period for about 3 or 4 years, have softened off, largely with the oil price, as long as everything. How do you see this one?
Yeah, look, this we kind of put this in the value compounder bucket. It's we've got good conviction over the order book. We've got record backlogs as well at the moment. So and some of the, you know, the dynamics within the renewable sector are also complementary to what they're doing in the oil and gas sector. So it's not just an oil play, even though the share price might tell you that at the moment, or the way it's been reacting. So you know, you can probably drive about 10% per annum growth out of this business, and it's not on a stupid valuation either. I think we're on about 14 times at the moment, maybe just slightly less than that.
Yeah, I've got 10 and a half times go forward anyway.
Yep, around about that level, current about 14 times. So yeah, we're quite happy with it. It's one of those ones that has been maybe talking about going to the full list, and we're very keen for it to remain where it is. So really for 2025, it's all about the execution and integration of the acquisitions, just making sure that those margins are pretty stable, and nothing, they don't need to do anything crazy to continue that 10% earnings growth. We think over the longer term. So yeah, nice, a really nice wee business.
And what's their exposure to the crude oil price as it comes down, in terms, particularly in terms of the order book? Because they have a really good order cover, I believe, but it depends on how firm that is in terms of whether the projects for the customers are also sort of dependent.
They don't tend to get much of a default rate, or they haven't in the past. And again, I'll just point out that it's not just about oil and gas.
You've
got a good chunk of that business, especially in the Aberdeen and the North Sea market, that is in the renewables, offshore wind. So, you know, we don't feel that it's a, you know, it's not a 50% geared to the oil price, but the problem is that the share price seems to be telling you that it is.
yeah,
at the moment.
Okay, good. Got a broader question from Luke. He's asking about what are your thoughts about investing in companies with a market cap of less than 50 million pounds, which I guess means liquidity problems for investing fund managers like yourself.
Well, Luke, we still do. I know that there's a lot that don't. In fact, some of the ones that no doubt we're going to come on and talk about started off at under 50 million market caps. And I think, you know, when we're looking at liquidity, we're not just looking at a market cap. We're looking at a shareholder list. So, you know, for both the way in and if we needed to, the way out as well. So ideally, you're looking for, you know, a reasonable free float and then some kind of friends and family, if you like, on the shareholder list as well. And even sometimes a management team that have got a reasonable chunk themselves, or an older family that have maybe got a reasonable chunk themselves. And very often you can find that companies that are under 50 million can be just as liquid as something that's double the size if you get the right dynamics on the shareholder list.
Yeah. And do you go on the board of companies you invest in, the smaller companies, or you're active in the background?
A combo of both. So we're not on the board of anything at the moment. We have been in the past, and we have got we've got monitoring rights in a couple. Monitoring rights. What does that mean? That means that we can attend but not vote at board meetings. So we're kind of that silent person in the room. And you know, what's the benefit of that? Benefit maybe to the company is that they get another sounding board. Benefit to us is that we are in the room, whether it be for kind of discussions on M&A activity or strategic decisions, and it allows us to be quite close to the company. It probably means that we're not going to be trading it, because we tend to be inside if we're attending board meetings at a certain point of the year. But once we bought our stake, it means that we can be slightly closer to the company than actually even just being on the board. We've got a number of companies where we've introduced board members to the company, a good number actually, if I look down the list. And that's probably the best of both worlds, because you've got somebody that you know and trust, and it's probably a bit better than a fund manager, dare I say it, at being on a board. So that's quite a useful thing to have.
Yeah, help steering the ship. Okay, we've got a question from Hamish. He's asking about Scottish house builder Springfield Properties, that again has been through trials and tribulations. I think it got a bit sort of like over leveraged about 2 years ago. It now seems to have sold off some land and is concentrating, rather than around the Edinburgh, Glasgow area, is concentrating, I think, in sort of the mid Scotland and also in northern Scotland to support all the renewables infrastructure and new electricities and stuff like this. How do you see this one? It's still trading at significant discount to net tangible assets.
Yeah, about a 25% discount. So this one's quite close to home for me, because I live in the Highlands, although I'm in London every week and seeing companies out and about. But I'm therefore very in tune with what's happening with SSEN in the north of Scotland. And there's basically a major new line going down the centre of the Highlands, and that is to make sure that all these new wind farms and offshore wind farms are connected to the grid properly, because the pylons or whatever that we have at the moment are not good enough. And frankly, there's just not enough housing. There's not enough housing anyway in the north of Scotland. And there's certainly not enough housing to accommodate the level of people that are now going to be coming into the area to build those lines. And then you've got the combination of that. There's two deep sea ports that are being built. One just outside Inverness, and then another slightly further north than that. And again, just absolutely no housing for that. So Springfield, they are sitting at a heavier discount to some of their peer group. You say that is the case because they have been overgeared. And then in the recent results, they then have sold off have done a deal to sell off a good chunk of their land bank, as you say, in that central Scotland.
I think it was to Barratt's, wasn't it? Half of it was to Barratt's. Yeah,
that's right. But they're not going to get the cash for that. The cash for that is going to be phased. So the gearing just doesn't disappear overnight. That will phase through. They've done the right thing. there's maybe a counter argument to that, to say that they've sold off some of their crown jewels to do the right thing in terms of reduced debt at maybe the wrong time in the housing cycle for the west and east of Scotland, or the central belt. But actually, what they've done really is double down on that investment in the north of Scotland. So actually, I think it's prudently run. Debt coming down is a bad thing. And I'm more than confident, given some of our local knowledge here, on what's happening with SSEN and the energy sector. So I think there's nobody else around in the north of Scotland that are capable of building decent homes in that kind of 50 estates, or between sort of 50 and 150 houses. There's just nobody else about, really. And I think it'd be very difficult to make a foothold in this area without the land bank that Springfield have got. So no, we like the dynamics there. Good team.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think it's quite, if you've got local knowledge, particularly where they operate and the growth prospects and the GDP growth prospects, given, specifically given a boost by all of the new renewable electricity infrastructure that needs to be put in, then yeah, it seems to be well supported. Okay, let's keep on to stay on the property theme. We've got Property Franchise Group, which I think is the leading sort of like estate agent in the UK, does about 50% of its revenues or more than that through lettings, and then another 50% is split between transactions and also financial products like helping people get mortgages and this sort of stuff. They recently bought or merged with Belvoir, and now they're sort of like a 200, 300 million market cap company. First of all, how do you see the prospects for that company, but also the broader the housing market going forward? Because it took a leg up heading into the sort of like the end of the Help to Buy, but now as sort of everybody's talking quite cautiously about the next few months.
Yeah, so they said themselves when they had the results out in the last sort of 6 weeks or so that they're going to have a challenging year. But this, I think there's probably a bit of self-help here as well. So they put the business, as you say, into kind of three different focuses. You've got the branding, franchising division, which YouMove is the main brand that they have there. They've then got financial services and they've got licensing. And really, it's I think they're going to get some economies of scale by putting the business into those three buckets. And also, they're not betting on the market being overly buoyant, but they are looking to grow market share against their competitors. It is quite a competitive market, as probably you would know, but you know, you're not overpaying for the business here, I don't think. You're looking at a PE of about 12-month rolling of about 11 times or thereabouts. And you've got a nice dividend yield. You know, you're being paid to hold this business in the meantime as well. It's nearly a 5% yield. It's a good, I think for us, it's quite nice to have exposure to this sector. And I don't really want to be in some of the bigger names like Rightmove, where, you know, that valuation seems to have kind of played itself out. And here you're looking probably to get about 20% earnings growth if you believe in the forecasts that are in the market. So, a bit of self-help, well-run business and some good brands, and, you know, growing market share as opposed to being completely dependent on the market going crazy itself. And I think it's probably going to be, as they said themselves, a challenging year, I suspect.
Yeah. And just in terms of sort of the lettings portion of it, which is obviously their recurring revenue streams, the new legislation coming in, I think it's the Renters' Rights Bill in October or something. And what you've got, and it has happened for some time, but there's a lot of mum and pop landlords who have decided to sell up. And then it's sort of aggregating into the bigger landlords like your Grangers of this world, but Build to Rent, etc. Presumably, that is, you know, that like the Granger, they do their own lettings, their own loan letting. And also, if you have more and more landlords, presumably they have some pricing pressure. I know greater volumes going to the property franchise. I was just wondering how you thought that might affect sort of like the growth in the lettings as things move up to bigger, more scalable landlords.
Yeah, I think so. Just looking back to what's happened in Scotland, actually, Scotland actually took the lead on that, which has now been rolled out in the UK basis as well. And you're absolutely right. It's definitely contracted the number of landlords out there, and they tend to be slightly larger and more corporate orientated as well. the markets in Scotland's coming back round a little bit to beginning to get a bit more fragmented down at the bottom end of things. But I think you're right to assume that the letting side of the business, which is the old Belvoir business, isn't it really?
I think
if I'm being if I'm trying to look through the looking glass on this one, that I think that's one of the reasons that Belvoir was quite keen to do a deal with Property Franchise, because they could see that headwind coming. And if you look at the forecast here on Property Franchise, they're not overly bullish on the letting side. So I don't think there's too much hopefully priced in on that aspect of things. But you're right, that market is definitely going to tighten.
Yeah, okay, good. I've got a question from Lemon Physical more broadly. Is obviously the small caps has, and every sort of like active manager has been hit by passives. How do you see the sort of the approach to sort of, I suppose it's marketing actives. I mean, I never use a passive simply because it's dumb to me. It's dumb money running after dumb money, and eventually it will come and got to. But in terms of sort of getting more people into active management, because you know, nowadays we've got so many bargains, but you've got to be a stock picker. You've got to select, particularly in AIM, as you mentioned earlier. And therefore, I know there's no tracker in AIM, but small cap sector, if you just buy a tracker, then frankly, you know, you haven't really got any alpha, whereas in active you have. So how do you sort of like look at marketing as on that perspective?
That's a very good question. It's ironic, isn't it? You know, we invest in a business called Tatton, which is one of probably, you know, they've got a good number of trackers and MPS within their own business, and they're not really active managers at all. And we love the business. But how do we manage to try and persuade people to invest in what we do? It's got to come down to what you can drive out of this area in the market. And we've got some great fund managers in our space, but we look at what we've managed to achieve in our AIM IHT portfolios. I think our latest numbers are up to the end of December. I can give you an idea as to what's happened then. But, you know, we're investing in 25 to 40 AIM companies, and we're up 170-odd% over the last 10 years plus. So it shows that you can drive compound returns from this area in the market. Yeah. And really, you know, what do people care about when they're investing? It is about the ability to drive returns. And we've seen that not just from us, but a number of other fund managers in this area. You looked at the AIM index itself. We've already talked about it, but 30-year-old this year, I would hate to say what it's actually done in that period compared to the FTSE, but it's probably pretty much maybe worse than flat line. So you can't sell the index itself, but you can sell the ability to stock pick. And you know, we've talked about, you know, some companies that are sitting on single digit PEs at the moment. You're not going to get that if you're investing in a tracker that's, as we know, investing in the Mag 7 and all that's happening there. So I actually think at this point in the cycle and with what's happening in the US, it's almost easier. It's probably the easiest time, actually, for us to go out and market and show the ability to generate returns from the types of companies that we've just been talking about. But yeah, it's not easy.
Yeah, that's the AIM one. So you're right. It's pretty much, if you look at it on a, how many years? Let's put a 30-year on. Because I'd only go, this part of AIM only goes back to basically 20-odd years. But you're right. It's lower than it was when it started. So I know it's not I know, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. No, I'm with you. I mean, if you look at sort of like the tried and tested small cap fund managers, yourself and Harwood and, you know, people like Richard Stavey, Lawrence Hall, I mean, they've all generated good long-term gains, and you know, it shows you can do it. And if investor wants to generate alpha, then you've got to basically take a longer term view and you know, have active money rather than just pick up sort of the Mag 7, which, yes, it's done well, but frankly, at some point in time, it's going to have a bath.
Yeah. And actually, what we're finding is that people, fund allocators are, instead of just being maybe 70-80% towards trackers, ETFs, they're now balancing their portfolio because they're scared as to what's happening. So they might sit alongside, or a fund like ours might sit alongside a tracker.
Yeah.
So, you know, that in itself is quite interesting, because you just didn't have that conversation 2 years ago.
Yeah. So, okay, good. One stock I know you've invested for some time, Eagle Eye, basically does sort of neat software for individualized promotions to help supermarkets sell, you know, extra products, etc. around the world. It's got some big clients in the UK, I think Tesco's and Asda and people like that. But the shares actually have come off a bit of late as the market's gone down. How do you see this one going forward, Judith?
Well, I think, you know, they had a bit of an own goal towards the tail end of last year. I think it was about November time. So they're one of these businesses that have been moving from, I suppose, one-off revenues from
perpetual licensing work.
And moving into SaaS.
Yeah.
And they probably got a little bit addicted to some of the project management consultancy that they were throwing into contracts. And that's fine. But they also realised that to become a better quality business, they needed the ARR, the annual recurring revenue, to really start kicking through properly. And so that move from project contracts to ARR, or SaaS as we call it, has really dented them just towards the tail end of last year. And that put question over their growth aspirations. And then at the same time, you had some of the big retailers just getting a little bit more cautious about life. So they don't just get paid on the project implementation of their software, but they also get paid on the loyalty side of their and transactions once the software is actually deployed. So when you had some of their customers taking a step back, especially in that supermarket space, and seeing that volumes were down, that had the double whammy at the same time as them moving some of their project business into the SaaS side of things. So we've had a bit of earnings hiatus, and this was probably one of the most expensive companies within the portfolio. Looking back, it was probably on a PE of about 27, 28 times.
Yeah, I was getting 30, yeah.
Yeah, so it was definitely one of the more expensive, and we were paying that because of the growth that we were getting delivered to us. However, it's on much. We're not getting the growth necessarily this year. I think we will have 12 to 18 months worth of a degree of self help. We're taking quite a bit of cost out of the business, and this move towards the better quality SaaS earnings. They've got one contract that's on the, well, it's done and it's ready to be deployed, and that's a contract with SAP, and that could be worth probably between 20 and 50 million of ARR a year, but they're really only just rolling that out in next month actually, so that will take a bit of time to deploy. And what they're trying to do there is make that an off-the-shelf product. So not having to have bespoke software engineering round about it, but really just rolling it out to all of that SAP market. And what they're replacing there is SAP's own loyalty and payment systems. So, you know, it's already an incumbent product that SAP are no longer supporting. So, you know, it should be a bit of a plug-in. But it's not there yet. So I think probably about 12 months worth of a bit of hiatus, but you're not having to overpay for it. And it's a good quality business where they are putting self-help into the business to help their own margins as well. So we actually, ironically, despite what I've said, we're going to see the margins go up, but the growth maybe not being quite as ambitious as it was before. So a nice business. We're keen to hold it.
So essentially, the SAP relationship, they're acting as a channel partner and plugging and playing a sort of out-the-box software from Eagle Eye into its Salesforce that then can sell as part of its cloud offering to all SAP's sort of customers in this space that may want that type of self, you know, individualized promotions. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And SAP's clients and customers are already buying a solution from them, but SAP had realized that it was costing them way too much to support, and also they were going up against Eagle Eye as a competitor. So they've, as you say, they're effectively the distribution for Eagle Eye through the SAP network. So this is their solution, SAP's solution in the loyalty space. So it really should be a decent earner for them going out the next 12 months or so. But, you know, it's only being launched internally within SAP this month, or sorry, next month. And then I'll have to, there'll no doubt have to be education around about it. And then the first deployment, et cetera. Mm. But it's going to be deployed by SAP people, not necessarily Eagle Eye people. So it should be light touch. Famous last words.
Yeah. Well, here's a prediction for you. Given Equalize current turnover is between sort of 45 to 50 million, if you add 20 to 30 million on top of that SAP, what's the chance SAP buys them?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. You know, this, I wouldn't want to see this business bought out at this stage. But it's you know, it's a market leader in its space. It's providing loyalty to, you know, the Asdas, the Tescos, then you know, any kind of high street brand that you can think of worldwide, you're getting exposure to through Eagle Eye. So yeah, nice business, but it could end up getting taken out. You're right.
Yeah, fabulous. Yeah, really good description. Thanks very much, Jude. Now we've got a question from Adrian. He's asking about hVIVO, which does human challenge trials in the UK large. I think they just built a big facility down in Greenwich in London. So they've got new beds and they've stacked up the order book, et cetera, to do those. And they've also, I think they just recently bought a cryogenic storage of human parts and stuff as well, a small little bolt-on to go more into the CRO type of services. The shares have halved over the last 6 months or so, largely on sort of, fears about what the US is going to do in terms of vaccines. But anyway, how do you see it, the business going forward?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting one. So we took an exposure about 8 or 9 months ago. So they had a record year in 2024. They've just actually announced it, I think, last week. So they had an absolute record year in 2024, and that was flattered by our client, ironically, that had come in and paid for a trial and then not actually wanted it. So that allowed them to build out the, so they basically had cash coming in that was 100% margin. So that's really what flattered 2024. So you've got to have that in your mind when you're looking at the numbers for 2025 and 2026. So you've probably got about 7 or 8 million of turnover that you take that out the numbers, then you see actually you do get growth in 2025 when you look at the numbers. So that's a kind of weird anomaly that you've got there. But that did allow them to build the Canary Wharf facility and add a good number of beds, but also quite a lot of efficiency to the business. I would say that this comes with a bit of a health warning because although it's cheap on paper, great return on capital employed, 25% of return on capital employed, good margins, chucks off cash. These contracts are really lumpy. So human trials, they probably deliver on maybe 5 or 6 of them a year. They've got a £69 million contracted order book, but actually knowing when those contracts are going to start is the difficult thing. So they're working with Big Pharma, and this might be, the trials probably come at kind of the end or near to the end of a drug development. So as we all know, that drug development can be rather patchy in terms of timing sometimes. So hVIVO, great business, but they're kind of at the behest of some of the large farmers on the actual timing. The great thing is that they get paid up front, or a good part of it up front, and they can't cancel. So once they're in the order book, they're going to get paid for them. So you get that certainty. But what the business has been trying to do is diversify away from those much, much larger contracts. As you say, they bought the cryogenics business more recently, but they also bought a kind of phase 1 trial business in Germany, CRS. That business is actually not profitable. So that for us was like, oh my goodness, what, buying an unprofitable business in another country. However, I got some really good people there and very complimentary in terms of the client base as well. So, and actually hVIVO, the chief exec, has been really good at turning around businesses. In fact, the original business that was at hVIVO was quite an unprofitable business that Mo helped turn around and create now the business that we've got today. So there's lots of moving parts here. It looks cheap. It's certainly got some lovely dynamics when it comes to its return on capital. But it definitely watched that lumpiness that you can get through this business as it stands today. But we certainly at these levels, we think it's quite attractive.
Yeah, apparently it's negotiating a blockbuster whooping cough trial contract with, I think it's Iliad Biotherapeutics or
technology. I mean, again, you know, we mentioned a big contract in terms of Eagle Eye. That can change the dynamics of the business. Yeah. HVivo, you know, it's rumoured that this contract could be worth £20 million. So the one thing that needs to happen there is that the Iliad need to get their funding for this project. But given that whooping cough's such an issue worldwide and the existing vaccines are now they're now intolerant to the actual disease.
Oh, right. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so something needs to be done, and Iliad have really got the only IP out there. So we'll know within the next couple of months as to whether Iliad get their funding or not.
Mm. Okay, good. Let's move back to the software sector. In all things rail tech, we've got Traxys. I know we've talked about this a lot. It was a shareholder darling, and then unfortunately came a bit off its tracks when the CP7 in the UK was delayed a bit. So they had a few sort of like problems with orders, and they've also got a bit delay from the early calling of the general election. They've got quite a big second half to hit, but the shares have re-rated now significantly, and they've still got the opportunity to go out to the States. Plus, they won this huge order, Tap and Go, with I think it was Network Rail to roll that out across all sort of like cities anyway. So lots of moving parts, cheap as chip, well, pretty cheap compared to it was. How do you see this one?
Yeah, I think you said it there. We've got results coming out the 25th, I think, so another 10 days' time. It's all about that CP7, which is the buying cycle for Network Rail. And, of course, it's been well rumoured that Labour, well, they've got other stuff on at the moment, but Labour might come back and look at privatising the rail network too. Mm. So there's quite a few unknowns here. But, you know, they are the dominant provider of condition monitoring equipment, both in the UK, but also Europe and now actually US. I think there's probably too much maybe expectation on the US business. I think that's taking longer and is harder than we probably anticipated at the start. And in their trading update in January, I think it was, their outlook statement was a little bit kind of caveated to conversion of pipeline and quite material contracts. And if I'm being cynical, not seen any of those coming through yet. That being said, it is it's now, I think it's on about 11 times, 12 times earnings.
Yeah, less than one time sales as well.
Yeah, exactly. So for this quality of business, if the forecasts are right, albeit that they do need 65% EPS growth on a year-on-year basis with some headwinds from the sector. You can tell I'm being slightly cynical as to whether they're going to meet the numbers or not. But, you know, it's still a business that we like to own. You're not going to get this kind of exposure to the rail network in very few other listed UK small cap businesses, actually. I can't really think of many others that you do get this exposure in. And also, they tend to benefit from the consultancy side in periods of disarray. And I can only imagine that if there was to be privatisation, there's going to be quite a lot of disarray. So, we're happy holders, but also quite opportunistic buying should the price come off a little bit. I think the forecasts are going to be quite punchy to achieve.
Yeah, well, I think most sensible investors have already baked in a profit warning for the second half. That's what the share price is saying. It may come off slightly more, but for such a high quality long term business, particularly with that Tap and Go contract, then that could really drive earnings not only in the UK but abroad if they can lift and shift the same software.
Yeah, okay. Early days for that, but yeah.
Okay, good. We've got another software company, Geospatial Company. I know we've talked about it. One Spatial does a lot of sort of like infrastructure geospatial asset management software for lots of pipes. And then they've got this app which does for One Street Works for managing traffic demand around roadworks in the UK that they're trying to scale up. Shares have come off a bit after a sort of like semi-profit warning in the year ahead. I think delays to a Belgian contract, I believe.
Yeah, it was about a €9 million contract, I think. So that's a delay there. So that's going to fall into next year. So that's really why the shares have come off a little bit. But, you know, SaaS revenues are up about 30-odd%, and good reoccurring revenue as well. This is another one where there's probably got to, you've got to be comfortable with the 2026 guidance to be comfortable with the valuation here. But it's put on about 8x EBITDA or thereabouts. Slightly more than that, actually, just looking at it.
I've got 7.5, actually. Yeah, okay. Forward. Yeah.
Okay. Excuse me, just 2 seconds. I'm just about to cough. So, yeah, it's been a business that needs, it's a lot based on new contracts coming through and Streetworks. Great. I don't know if we talked about what that product actually does, but it's a planning tool for, as just as it says, for Streetworks. And it takes an awful lot of the time out of any council planning and, the rigmarole of engineers deciding where they want to be at certain times. And literally it's a tool that you can press a button on and get a Streetwork planning application that you can then start pushing through. So that's been quite a big thing for them, not just in the UK, but also in the US as well. So, I think seeing more contracts coming through on that side would be reassuring for the 2026 numbers. So, again, just a little bit of caution on what it looks like quite a punchy number for 2026.
Yeah, no, it looks good. In terms of selling that one Streetworks to councils, have they got any spare budget? I mean, they may want it, but it just is like, it's like affordable. It's like the affordable housing sector. The housing associations haven't got any money, so they can't execute against the government's desire to do 1.5 million homes. And likewise with the councils. I mean, I live in Birmingham, and you know what Birmingham City Council, they can't pay the bin guys to actually collect the rubbish. So these councils are really in a tough spot at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's all about this cost-saving thing, isn't it? So it's probably got to be part of our overall solution where you end up taking engineering heads out. So I think they see, definitely, I mean, Surrey and some of the other councils who have taken the initiative here and spearheading the uptake of this, they are basically showing it as a return on invested capital. So in other words, get this in and you're going to be able to take heads out of the business, out of the councils.
Yeah. Good.
But you've got to get them thinking about it that way first.
Yeah. Good. I noticed you've got a couple of good counter-cyclical plays in the portfolio. Let's go to Ramsdens, which is a sort of like a mixture between sort of like a pawnbroker, but also does sort of gold sales and other jewellery sales, foreign exchange, and came out with some results. And the shares have responded very, very positively last week from a cheap valuation. How do you see this one? And just briefly about H&T as well, which is the UK's largest pawnbroker.
Yeah, we own both, which might sound a bit weird, but they're quite different. So Ramsdens tends to be more in the north, whereas H&T is kind of south, southeast. H&T is obviously much significantly larger in terms of its pledge book. Ramsdens probably a bit more diversified when it comes to, it's got pledge, and it's got FX, and it's got jewellery as well. Same as H&T, but pledge really is the majority of the H&T business. It's been a lot talked about in terms of gold price over the last couple of weeks. And if I'm being cynical, probably Ramsdens has benefited from that in the last 2 or 3 weeks as well. I think people have looked for that kind of counter-cyclical exposure and a way to get access to that gold price through a slightly different mechanism. But it's still really cheap as well, isn't it? It's still single-digit PE, great return on capital, really well-run business. They're not stupid when it comes to rolling out more stores. I think, you know, if you look at growth here, growth does come from new store rollout and retrofits. It's, you know, you can get the existing stores to work a little bit better, but you're not going to get double digit earnings growth from just purely the existing store network. So you are looking at sensible rollout here as well. FX has done pretty, you know, it's been pretty steady, £380 roughly in terms of FX, average person coming in to buy FX. And then you've got the jewellery side that has, it was probably a little bit in the doldrums if you go back a couple of years, but they've now got quite a good online offering as well. So I think it's just a nice, steady balance sheet leader here. So this company, Ramsay, has got net cash in the balance sheet.
Yeah.
H&T's got net debt. So they're, I would maybe argue that they're less efficient on pushing some of their inventory through store, where I think Ramsden's very efficient at it. We've got a small position in H&T, whereas we own about 13-14% of Ramsden's.
Okay,
so, a nice business and very prudent management team.
Okay, I've noticed one of your largest, but we've got Tony asking about Hargreaves Services, which I think is a bit of a special situation. It's got sort of like property management. It's also got sort of civil contracting. And then likewise, I think it's got a sort of like a renewables business, or should we say commodities business out in Germany, or joint venture. How do you see this one sort of like crystallizing its value?
Another common theme here is Mr. McDowell.
Yes.
Some of the parts, once again, I think on this one, it's a bit of a conglomerate. It used to be the UK's largest miner of coal, believe it or not, go back 10 years or so, but that's actually left it with quite a good land bank. So how do we look at it? On valuation grounds, you're probably looking at, about £9 a share thereabouts, I think is probably consensus view as well. It's now got net cash in the balance sheet. So services, probably about 100 million. So that's about 10 times earnings. So you're probably not going to get much more than that, because you've got a degree of contract risk or side contract size risk. Land bank, Blindwells, which is the site in Edinburgh, 48 million book value. Could be about 5 million a year of profit. So 120 million maybe. And then HMRS, which is the German business, probably about 70 million book value. And we have already been told that they're looking to repatriate some of the cash there. So that can get you to about £9. What happens first? That's probably quite a good question. Some of the renewables assets that we've already talked about most likely to be sold off this year. And that is about, it's in the public domain, is about 28, 29 million of value there. So that might either mean a special dividend, which they've obviously been quite good at paying in the past. And then we'll get the continued Blindwells property side throwing off cash as well. So it won't all happen overnight, but you can see some real catalyst to unlock value here.
Yeah, it sort of falls into the first two buckets, doesn't it? Self-help, but also actually the balance sheet strength, that it just is a matter of crystallizing it and monetizing the asset base, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we've got one question from Ian. He's asking about Frenkel Toppy. We don't normally talk about it. It's a specialist sort of like a provider of legal services to people who have been injured in private accidents, and also NHS negligence claims. It does all the legal services and advice, and then actually helps the person who's been injured manage those funds. And the funds under management have been growing, and the business seems to be doing pretty well. Obviously, it's underneath the sort of the duty of care new laws coming from the FCA. But the shares keep dropping, and I was looking at the numbers, and it's trades at 8x PE. What's the worry? Is it just cool?
It's got. I mean, you look at the valuation on it; it's about a 10% free cash flow yield, off cash. So they, from being critical about them, they have been pretty poor at hitting numbers bang on. You know what I mean by that? Sometimes they might hit the earnings, but they might miss in revenue. So there's always a bit of a story as to how they managed to get there. They have been quite acquisitive through the past as well. So they had a business that I think was called Partners in Cost. They probably, with the benefit of hindsight, didn't integrate quite as well as they should have done. And so they had a period last year where they really had to sort that out. And I suspect there's probably a degree of cynicism over them being able to deliver on these numbers. But actually, I do feel much more confident about them, touch wood, much more confident about them delivering on their numbers than they ever have been. And a couple of reasons for that. One is that they sorted out that parts and cost business that had been a bit of a millstone around their neck. Their performance, if you look at the performance on their asset management side of the business, it's really good. So they're actually beginning to win contracts in their own right. So they're winning mandates in that asset management business that's not just associated with their core business, where they're passing investors through to the asset management side. So they're actually a good little asset manager themselves. And I think it's just a better balanced business than it was 12 months ago. They'd set up a money market fund, and they're now converting that money market fund investors into their asset management side. So you automatically get a margin improvement there. I think the money market fund was on it, something like 18 or 20 bips, and the asset management side would be on it 55, 65 bips. So I think there's just a lot of self-help that they don't need to be shooting the lights out and winning new clients to be getting the kind of numbers that we see in the market that puts it on a single digit PE. I think it's probably one of the cheapest things in the portfolio at the moment.
How liquid are the shares in terms of, if you want somebody wanted to buy the shares, I'm guessing it's the market cap is what, 41 million, so I'm guessing it's a tough one.
It's not that liquid, and it's quite well held by Harwood. In fact, Christopher Mills is chair now. He went on the chair within the last 12 months. So it's not that liquid, but you know, saying that, we managed to pick up stock and we've got it as a core position in a portfolio. So you just tickle away at it and you can tend to get what you need. But it's a 40 odd million market cap company. So
We've got a follow-up from Luke. I don't know whether you still own it. XP Factory, which is basically does the boom battle button. They don't own it. Okay, consumer stuff.
No, not really.
Okay, good.
Well, I think we used to have it a few years ago, but we don't follow it anymore.
Okay, good. Let's go for the final one. Let's go for food distributor in the UK, Kitwave, which basically does impulse sort of ice creams, tobacco, drinks and stuff to a lot of convenience stores, but also increasingly to the food service sector as restaurants and sort of like takeaway joints and people like that. On a buy and build strategy, I think you bought Creed Food Service last year, which seems to be integrating. Shares are pretty cheap. Which bucket do you view this one in, and what's it sort of like? Its prospects.
Sometimes you put them in certain buckets, they end up moving. So in the past we've had a few value compounders that have ended up going into self help. But actually, we do think this is a good value compounder business. Got a decent market share. A good acquisition last year. Didn't overpay for it. And you know, just a really nice fit, actually. We want to see the further integration of that. We had results just about a month ago, and you know, it was a good update. I think there was some headwinds from the tobacco side of the business, but and that's only 3% margin, so we're a little bit cautious on that. But otherwise, I think you're looking at a business that can continue to grow by sort of 10% per annum, and your valuation on it isn't crazy either. Yeah. Again, another single-digit PE business with a free cash flow yield that's certainly above 15%. I looked at it the other day. So, and you've got a dividend that is up at 5% as well. So, no, it's a good, solid business that I think really dictated by its market share as much as anything else. Mm. It's not a deep value company by any means, but you've got some really nice growth attributes coming through there too. And it would probably be an inflationary beneficiary too, depending on what your view is on what might happen in inflation over the course of the next 12 months.
Yeah. And these ones, these sort of like network, or should we say root density businesses, eventually get taken out because a bigger boy will look at it and think, okay, right, I can lift and shift the whole of this company straight onto my existing platform and service all the customers using my existing vans and depots. And you get that each van driver then can go and service 70 rather than 50 in the same sort of locality.
Yeah, that's No, it's a nice business.
Good. Okay. A hard question here, Judith, that I ask everybody, just in the sort of the context of this, the background of all the volatility, what sort of like stock would sort of most be appropriate for sort of like in your portfolio, or ones you sort of like would highlight to investors as something they should do, as an idea that they should look at? I know it's a difficult one.
I know. And I also get killed for this from a compliance point of view. So I'm not allowed to give recommendations, obviously.
Yes.
But we have, I suppose, first off, we looked at two or three there in the portfolio that are, that I've said, you know, are quite cheap. Some of them for reasons that we know about, where there might be some sort of headwinds, tailwinds, that are kind of a bit of a maelstrom at the moment. But there's one business that we've not talked about, and that is a business that's quite cheap and it's also got some really good growth, can't even say it, good growth momentum behind it too. And that's a business called Synectics. That's the old Quadnetics as it used to be back in the day. And actually, so they I'm going to try and paraphrase what they do, but they're in command and control with CCTV. So they're selling into the oil and gas sector. They're selling into casino sector. And you're going to say the share price has already gone up quite substantially over the last 12 months or so, but it's still on a single digit PE. And when I look at the contracted forward order book, my confidence in them being able to deliver on the 26 numbers and actually even forward into 27 numbers, it's exceptionally high. So I've got conviction on this this company and its ability to deliver. And that's because it's selling into end markets where infrastructure, oil and gas, where there's a real need both in the retrofit market, but also for new product coming through. And their self-help, throwing that into the mix as well, their self-help has meant that they've really managed to improve their margins quite substantially over the last sort of 12 months or so. And I don't think that's really appreciated by the market. So though the share price is up quite considerably, it's a little minnow that I think is also capable of most likely getting taken out at some stage.
Yeah, no, it's still only on 12 times PE, pays a 2% dividend yield. And I'm with you, actually. I think the government at the moment, and these are the governments around the world, particularly in the West, are redefining what is critical infrastructure, things like data centers and IP backbones and all this sort of stuff. And therefore, they are going to be mandated that they're going to need CCTV or some sort of surveillance. And they could actually be really well placed to see a bit of a boom in that whole monitoring of infrastructure.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks very much, Judith. Brilliant comments as always and insights. Thanks everyone for your questions, and keep your head down, and hopefully all us investors will come through this very turbulent period. Any sort of key messages for investors before we finish there, Judith? Anything you'd like to say?
Don't change what you're doing, just keep doing it.
Okay, good. All right, thanks again, Judith, and look forward in touching base in 6 months time.
Great. See you soon.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.